We only have two more chapters left. Or actually, we have only two more chapters left. And they both deal with nitrogen metabolism. Something we really haven't talked about yet at all. Why is nitrogen important to organisms? What is it? Right. Every amino acid, amino means nitrogen containing, right? So every amino acid requires nitrogen just to qualify as an amino acid. Therefore, every polypeptide is chock full of nitrogen. No cell does very well without proteins, right? Because proteins do almost all the important jobs in cells. What else? Where else do we see nitrogen? In terms of biomolecules. Organic macromolecules. Well, let's go back to day one. What are these four macromolecules? Polysaccharides, lipids, nucleic acids, and what's the fourth? Polypeptides, right. Well, we just said that polypeptides, being made of amino acids, require nitrogen, but so do nucleic acids, right? So even if you had the nitrogen to build a protein, because you had the nitrogen for the amino acids that you need to build the protein, you're not able to build that protein unless you have the instructions for how to do so, right? Which are in nucleic acids. And a nucleic acid is a polynucleotide, right? Well, what are the three components of any nucleotide? A sugar, a phosphate, and a nitrogenous base. So every subunit of every polypeptide and every subunit of every polynucleotide has nitrogen in it. And therefore, nitrogen is absolutely vital to all life, all organisms. In fact, viruses, which aren't even organisms, absolutely require nitrogen, right? So we're going to talk about amino acid degradation in this chapter. Now, amino acids are subunits, of course, of polypeptides. They also, though, can be transformed into nucleic acids. But if you just think about amino acids as subunits of polypeptides, there's always a pool of amino acids in a cell because there is always protein turnover. Proteins are continuously being manufactured in a cell by what process? Translation. And proteins are continuously being degraded into amino acids. So no protein is permanent. And by far, most proteins aren't even close to being permanent. Proteins can last from minutes to months, depending on what the protein type is and what tissue it's in. Structural proteins tend to hang around longer. Other proteins, like enzymes and things that control metabolism, they don't hang around for very long because their intentional destruction is part of control. Right? One way that you can control an enzyme is by destroying it when you don't need it anymore. Right? But proteins, even if it would be beneficial to the cell for to have them hang around for a longer time, eventually they get oxidized, they undergo damage. So proteins are not permanent, they're continuously being destroyed, and you're continuously building new ones by going back to the drawing board, the genes that code for their synthesis. And so amino acids, you can think of as being building blocks, but they're also what you create when you disassemble a protein. Now, we're bringing protein into our bodies dietarily, of course. We eat proteins, and that's an important source for building blocks of new proteins that we make. But a lot of the proteins we make, we can make just from the amino acids that came from other proteins that we've just destroyed. When we have an overabundance of amino acids, more than we need to build the new proteins that we need at the moment, then we can use amino acids for fuel as long as we get rid of the ammonia that's in them. If you think back to all the metabolic pathways we've been discussing throughout the term, most of those had to do with fuel processing. But think about all the intermediates that we've been talking about in all these pathways. None of them involve nitrogen, right? So fuels don't contain nitrogen. Fuels are carbohydrates and lipids, really, right? Which is, they contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, but they weren't nitrogenous. So if we strip the nitrogen off of extra amino acids that we happen to have, we can use what's left over as fuel if we process it correctly. But then that leaves us with nitrogenous waste. And when we take the nitrogen off of an amino acid, what we're doing is deaminating it. We're taking the amino group off of the amino acid. So we don't take just the nitrogen atom, we take an amino group. In other words, what we strip from amino acids is ammonia, the simplest nitrogenous compound, right? Even simpler than pure nitrogen, because pure nitrogen is two nitrogen atoms, right, in a nitrogen molecule. Well, that's a more complex molecule than ammonia, because even though there's four atoms in ammonia, NH3, those three hydrogens are still smaller than one extra nitrogen atom, right, in terms of subatomic particles. So anyway, ammonia gets stripped from amino acids, and it's an important biological intermediate because it's a starting point for building other nitrogenous compounds, nucleic acids and amino acids included. But in high concentrations, ammonia becomes toxic to cells, interferes with the moment-to-moment operations. And so if you have extra amino acids and therefore process them by removing their aminos and therefore start building up ammonia, something needs to be done with this ammonia. Well, first of all, ammonia is a complete molecule, right? It's neutral. But ammonia, you might recall from general chemistry, acts as a strong base. A base is the opposite of a proton, of an acid, right? An acid is a proton donor, a base is a proton acceptor. So in biological solution, in the liquids in cells, in other words, ammonia takes on an additional proton from solution and becomes an ammonium ion, NH4+. So that NH4+, ammonium ions, in overabundance are nitrogenous waste that needs to be dealt with. different kinds of organisms, depending on their lifestyle and where they live, deal with that differently. Fish, for instance, just get rid of their ammonia into the watery medium in which they live. So they basically continuously release ammonia into the surroundings and they're done with it. Terrestrial organisms deal with it differently. If an organism has as its main final nitrogenous waste compound ammonia, it's called ammonia telic. Ammonia O and then T-E-L-I-C, one word. Terrestrial organisms are not ammonia telic, including us, of course. Mammals, like us, are classified as ureotelic because we transform our ammonia into urea before ridding our bodies of it. Now, urea itself is toxic in high is something you don't want to have in too high concentration either. But it's less toxic than ammonia and allows us to store it until we can get rid of it. And so urea is a major component of urine. And a lot of this chapter is about the urea cycle. Reptiles, including birds, are classified as uricotelic. They make ammonia and urea to a certain degree, but they also make uric acid, which is an even longer term storage form of the nitrogenous waste. But in any case, we need to deal with this ammonia somehow when we have extra amino acids that we're degrading. The carbon skeleton that is represented by the black part of this amino acid, like I said, can go on and be used as a fuel. Maybe there's some rearrangement that's necessary, but you can easily make it into one of the various intermediates in the metabolic pathways that we've already talked about. The blue amino group is what becomes the waste. And so the general scheme in this first slide shows you that whatever the amino acid is, we don't know what this amino acid is because the fourth position here is just R. Could be any of the amino acids. What we usually do with most amino acids that we're degrading is to strip the amino and end up making glutamate, which itself is an amino acid, right? Glutamate is the deprotonated form. If you had COOH, we would call it glutamic acid, right? So some books will list the amino acids, this amino acid, as glutamic acid. Glutamate is its other name, right? But it's one of the amino acids as well. By passing the amino groups from other aminos onto something that forms glutamate, we then have a way to get rid of the amino group as free ammonia, which becomes ammonium, which is why after glutamate you have NH4. Okay? Now that's not the end of the line, but that gets rid of the nitrogenous waste, and then we deal with that by making urea. So that's the general scheme. And just like the previous chapter, there's a hell of a lot of detail that we just have to skip because there are 20 different amino acids that organisms use for their proteins, and therefore there are all kinds of variations on pathways. So we can't look at all the details like we normally do. We're going to skip most of it, but that means fewer enzyme names to memorize. So this is, a lot of these slides are generalized. In slide 2, This is an example of a generalized slide. What we have in the upper left is some amino acid. We don't know what it is because it's just R1. Could be any of the 20. But in general, what happens is that the amino acid that needs to be degraded has its amino stripped from it, and that amino gets stuck onto some keto acid. This is an alpha keto acid shown in green. We don't know what specific alpha keto acid that is because, notice, it also just has another R group, unspecified. But it's an alpha keto acid, which we've talked about before, because this first carbon after the carboxyl, which is what makes it an acid, features a keto group, right? What alpha keto acids have we talked about before, or what one that we have we talked mostly about? Which one? Alpha keto glutarate, exactly. And that is the one that's most often used in this generalized scheme that's shown on this slide. Doesn't have to be, there are other variations as well. But what we're looking at here is a transamination reaction, because an amino group is being transferred from one compound to another. The amino acid that's being degraded is losing its amino. That's being transferred to an alpha keto acid. Well, that transforms the alpha keto acid into an amino acid itself, because that's really the difference between an alpha keto acid and an amino acid, is that the alpha keto acid doesn't have the amino group, but the amino acid does. So when you strip the amino off of the amino acid and put it onto the alpha keto acid, the green alpha keto acid turns into some amino acid itself. And what's left of the original amino acid becomes itself a keto acid. All right? So it might seem like a foolish thing to do because all you've done is shuffled around the amino. But the point is here is that you're getting to the point of having the correct amino acid. In most cases, like we saw in slide one, glutamate, so that it can then pass its amino group off as free ammonia, which can be incorporated into urea. All right? So there's all kinds of different enzymes that do this depending on what amino acid you're starting with degrading. But they all classify as aminotransferases, the enzymes do. But they are also called transaminases. Those are interchangeable terms. The better word is aminotransferase, but you might see the word transaminases, because this is a transamination reaction. Okay, like I said, the most used one of those alpha keto acids that receives the amino group from the amino acid you're degrading is alpha keto glutarate. And when that occurs, when alpha-ketoglutarate, let me just go back to slide two. Actually, I haven't even announced that we're on slide three yet. But if this green on the top, if this green alpha-keto acid is alpha-ketoglutarate specifically, and it receives the amino group from whatever amino acid's being deaminated, then the specific amino acid that's made in that case is glutamate, which is what we're seeing in the reverse of in slide three. Okay? Well, after that glutamate is made, then, like I said, glutamate is kind of the master amino acid that's used in the degradation of most amino acids. You end up, in most cases, making glutamate. And then you undo that the process you just performed, the glutamate that's just received that amino group then releases it as free ammonia, which becomes ammonium ions on the right here. And that leaves you with alpha-ketoglutarate again. In other words, alpha-ketoglutarate is recycled in this process. But this accomplishes the release of free ammonia, inorganic ammonia, because it's no longer associated with a carbon skeleton. And that can be used to produce urea so that it doesn't build up to toxic levels. Okay? Notice that this involves NAD or NADP. It's an unusual enzyme, and then it can use either coenzyme, NAD or NADP, both. But if you're, this is a reversible reaction, so this, if you run this in the reverse to how it's written, you can use this reaction as a source of producing glutamate if you need it as an amino acid. But go ahead. Well, I was just getting to that. It's called glutamate dehydrogenase. And that's named for the way it's written here, from left to right. Glutamate is losing the hydrogens up here in the amino group and the hydrogen in black next to it. That's what forms this keto group. But those hydrogens need to go somewhere, right? Well, they go on to NAD plus or NADP plus, reducing it into NADH or NADPH. So, this in terms of goals, this is nice because you are liberating that amino as free ammonia for use in incorporating it into urea to get rid of it. But you're also getting valuable reductive power out of this because you're reducing NADP or NADH, I mean NAD, into the reduced form, which then of course can be used for reductive biosynthesis if it's NADPH, or for production of ATP and oxidative phosphorylation if NADH is used and can deliver to those electrons to the electron transport chains. All right, well, slide 4 shows you this, basically incorporates the last few slides into one. The idea here is that some amino acid that needs to be degraded loses its amino group, becomes, after it loses the amino group, an alpha-keto acid. The alpha-keto acid can be rearranged into some intermediate that can be put into a fuel metabolic pathway. Okay? But the amino gets dropped off to alpha-ketoglutarate, transforming it into glutamate, which then is the right substrate for glutamate dehydrogenase, the enzyme that just worked in the previous slide, in order to free that ammonia, nitrogenous waste as ammonia, which becomes ammonium ions in solution. And that's going to recycle the alpha-ketoglutarate, because when it loses the amino, that's what you get back. All right? So as long as you have an excess of amino acids, because you've already built the proteins you need, and you just have extra amino acids, you're getting fuel in the form of the alpha-keto acids that can feed into metabolic pathways. You're getting reduced coenzymes, and you're getting rid of the nitrogenous waste, which you can then form into urea. And you see urea finally in this slide. Fairly simple molecule. It really is just a carbonyl with two ammonias stuck to it. Or two aminos, I should say, stuck to it. All right? And so the urea that's formed in order to more safely and but still temporarily storing this nitrogenous waste, that occurs where primarily in us? Well, where would you guess based on where everything else important has happened? In the liver, yes. The liver, tack on to its long list of important jobs, is responsible for producing urea in order to deal with this accumulation of ammonia. Okay? Now, urea, like I said, that stores it in a less toxic form, but an overabundance of urea is also a problem if you don't get rid of it, right? What do we call that clinically? You have too high a concentration of urea, it starts to crystallize. It comes out of solution, precipitates into uric acid, and that's called gout, exactly, which is painful as hell for one thing, but also causes problems of various sorts. Okay, well, let's look at slide 5 now. And this is a cycle that involves muscle and liver, muscle primarily. It could be other tissues as well, but muscle primarily. This is very similar to the Corey cycle that we already looked at in a previous chapter. In the Corey cycle, in case you forget, pyruvate that's produced in a very active muscle gets fermented, right? Or through fermentation produces lactate, which then goes to the liver and gets transformed back into glucose via gluconeogenesis, which then gets delivered back to the muscles for use as fuel. You remember that? This is very similar, only it's a little bit more complicated. The liver is the primary site for urea synthesis, like I said before. So the liver has the enzymes required for the urea cycle, which we still haven't looked at, but will anon. Muscles, on the other hand, don't have all of those enzymes responsible for conducting the urea cycle. So in muscles that are highly active, of course the primary fuels are carbohydrates and lipids. But in a muscle that really needs the extra energy at the moment, branched chain amino acids, which means the amino acids that in their R group have a branched arrangement to their carbon skeleton. They're not just a linear arrangement. Those can be processed by the muscle and used for energy. Like I said a little bit ago, though, to use an amino acid as energy, you need to deaminate it first so that you just have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen left to use for that fuel. Well, this is what the muscles are doing right here. Actually, before we get to that, let's just look at these numbered pathways, almost all of which we've already studied. So glycogen in the muscle, remember, most of the body's glycogen is stored in the muscle because there is so much muscle. That's being, in times when you really need the energy, the glycogen is being degraded by glycogenolysis, right? That yields glucose to use as fuel. So glycogenolysis is number one. Once you have the glucose, then you can use glycolysis to get some energy out of the glucose. That's two. That, of course, yields pyruvate. Now, here's where the branched chain amino acids come into play. When these branched-chained amino acids in the muscle are deaminated, that leaves carbon skeletons that can then be fed into cellular respiration pathway to yield more ATP. But the ammonium that's coming off of that in this slide then gets added to pyruvate that's also being produced because of glycolysis, and that forms alanine. All right? Which itself is an amino acid. Alanine then leaves the muscle cells, gets dumped into the bloodstream. And this is the primary means by which nitrogen, ammonia, gets transported to the liver via alanine. So the alanine gets dumped into the bloodstream. The blood, of course, eventually makes it to the liver. The liver takes up the alanine and then deals with it. What you can see here is that the alanine gets converted into glutamate and pyruvate. The glutamate then is what is necessary to make urea, which is what the liver is responsible for. That's what the muscle couldn't do directly. That's why it had to send the alanine to the liver. But the pyruvate that's produced in that process in the liver is just what you need for gluconeogenesis, right? Which is pathway 5 here. So in addition to getting the nitrogen out of alanine in order to make urea, what's left over is pyruvate, which can then be used by that same liver cell to run the gluconeogenic pathway to make glucose again, which it then releases into the bloodstream so it can go back to the muscle to be used for additional fuel. And so it's a cycle because of that, and it's called the glucose-alanine cycle. It's actually more efficient than the Cori cycle because you don't involve that step of converting pyruvate into lactate, which is wasteful in terms of NAD, right? Because NADH has to be used to transform pyruvate into lactate so that you have NAD plus again, right? Well, you don't have that occurring here, so you can use more of the electrons from the original fuel for oxidative phosphorylation this way. Okay, slide 6. I said that alanine is the primary means by which ammonia gets transported through the blood. Another way, though, is by converting glutamate into glutamine. Now, these are two different amino acids. The difference is that glutamate has only one amino group, the amino group that it has to have in order to be an amino acid, whereas glutamine has an additional amino group as part of its R group. And so what happens here is that glutamate can take on an additional amino in the form of ammonia, that's ammonium ions that are in solution that came from amino acid degradation, pick that up and become glutamine, which then gets transported in the blood. The liver will take it up just like it does alanine and deal with the glutamine similarly. Basically, what happens is the liver will reverse this, make glutamate and ammonium ions again, both of which are required, as we'll see in, I think, the next slide, for producing urea. And glutamine synthetase is the name for the enzyme that does this. Pretty self-explanatory, but why is this called glutamine synthetase and not glutamine synthase? You remember the difference between synthetase and synthase? Right, synthetases synthesize things using ATP. Synthases synthesize things without using ATP. And notice ATP is required here. So it's glutamine synthetase. All right, well, slide 7 is just a picture of urea. I've already shown you a picture of this, but it's a symmetrical molecule. Symmetrical even though the two sides here are drawn differently, right? H2N is really the same thing as NH2, right? It's just that the N has to be the connection point because the nitrogens are the ones making the three bonds. But pretty simple molecule, like I said, and small enough, once it's made, to make its way through the tiny pores that are in the glomeruli. Where are the glomeruli? In the kidneys, right. A glomerulus is a little balled-up coil of blood vessel, capillary, that when blood goes through that, it's not, I shouldn't say tangle because it's not really a tangle, but it's all balled up. When the blood goes through that capillary, the blood pressure forces anything that's small enough to go through the little holes that are in the wall of that capillary, just like watering hoses, right, that are full of little holes. The hydrostatic pressure, once you turn the spigot on, will force water out of the leaking hose. That's how your kidneys work. Anything that's small enough, whether it's something you want or not, gets forced out. Well, that includes urea. Then the good stuff that you didn't want to actually lose gets brought back in, and you leave the bad stuff out. But it's the liver that makes the urea. It's the kidney that actually gets rid of it from the blood. And that's what urine is. It's really just blood that's been filtered. Blood is urine plus extra stuff. When you leave that extra stuff behind, what you have is urine. All right, slide 8. What we're looking at here is the urea cycle. And so, once again, we're in the liver. But in this hepatocyte, or liver cell, two major compartments are being used here. So the pink box represents the mitochondrial matrix, as you see here. Part of this urea cycle occurs within the mitochondrion. Part of it occurs out in the cytoplasm, the rest of it here. Okay, now, the part that occurs inside the mitochondrion occurs within the mitochondrion because that way the ammonium ions, free ammonium ions, are sequestered away from the rest of the cell. They're in their own organelle. And the ammonium ions, like I said, are toxic in high levels. So you want to keep those away from the rest of the cell as much as possible. All right, so that glutamate dehydrogenase enzyme that we were talking about in a previous slide, that is what takes the ammonia from glutamate, that's occurring within that is inside the mitochondrion as well. So that's where you have the ammonium building up. Well, notice on the bottom here that ammonium and carbon dioxide are going to combine into an intermediate called carbamoyl phosphate. So called because the amino and carbonyl part of that in green and pink are collectively called carbamoyl. And then when you have a phosphate added on, you have carbamoyl phosphate. Now, this single blue arrow implies that this just happens in one step. It's really a few steps, all catalyzed by the same enzyme, though, which we'll look at in the next slide. That enzyme that's represented by this blue arrow is carbamoyl phosphate synthetase. But like I said, we'll look at the details of those three steps in the next slide. Anyway, once you have the carbamoyl phosphate, you've incorporated one of the two aminos that you need to make a complete urea. All right? But you need another amino to make urea. So, still inside the mitochondria, this carbamoyl phosphate then gets incorporated with ornithine, which is another amino acid. It's not one of the 20 amino acids that organisms use to build proteins, but remember, there's no limit to the number of amino acids. So there are other amino acids besides the basic set of 20. Ornithine is one of them. Notice ornithine is coming into the mitochondrion from out in the cytoplasm. And when it gets combined with carbamoyl phosphate, you make citrulline, which is another amino acid. And then citrulline gets exported. So embedded in this inner mitochondrial membrane, along with all the other proteins we've already talked about, are antiporters. And what is an antiporter? It's a co-transport molecule, therefore meaning that it transports two different kinds of particles at the same time. But there are two kinds of co-transporters, right? Symports and antiports, or symporters and antiporters. Antiports are co-transporters that move the two different molecules in opposite directions. So, in this case, they are swapping ornithine, which is coming into the mitochondrion, for citrulline, which is being transported out into the cytoplasm. Okay? So that's the part that happens in the mitochondrion. Once you have that citrulline come out, notice that it gets combined with aspartate, which is the deprotonated name for aspartic acid, another one of the 20 biological or protein amino acids. That forms arginosuccinate, as you see, which then gets transformed into arginine and fumarate. So fumarate is being kicked off in this as part of this urea cycle. Where do you know fumarate from? Citric acid cycle, good. So fumarate is valuable stuff in its own right. It can be used as fuel, basically, because it feeds directly into the citric acid cycle. The arginine, the other thing produced when arginosuccinate gets decomposed, then is what that is what then is the final intermediate to drop off its amino group, forming urea. I should say amino groups. Okay? So what's left after urea comes off of arginine is ornithine. And so you've completed the cycle. Ornithine then can be swapped for more citrulline and it can continue. So the two things that you're making here are the urea, which you're making not because it's valuable, but because you have to get rid of the nitrogen. And you're making fumarate, which is valuable as a fuel. All right? Well, let's look at slide 9 then, which is what's happening in the mitochondrion. Remember I said that this enzyme is called carbamoyl phosphate synthetase, which is a good name because notice it requires ATP. Requires ATP two different places. It's all the same enzyme that's doing all three of these steps. But this is the detail that the blue arrow didn't show in the previous slide. Bicarbonate is shown on the left. Why bicarbonate? Right. Bicarbonate is the storage form of CO2 in bodily fluids, right? Because when CO2 combines with water, we have carbonic acid, which is made, which then decomposes into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions. So bicarbonate ions are carrying the carbon and oxygen of what was originally CO2. In the previous slide, it was shown as CO2 and NH4+, but the CO2 really is in the form of bicarbonate, as you see in slide 9. So bicarbonate becomes phosphorylated by the ATP. That makes carboxyphosphate, well named. The phosphate, or the phosphoryl group that has just been received by bicarbonate to make it carboxyphosphate, now leaves again and gets displaced by an amino group coming from ammonia. Of course, it's not ammonia. It would be in the form of ammonium ions. But the ammonium ions get temporarily converted into ammonia in order to work with the enzyme. Anyway, though, the nitrogen of that ammonia is what gets stuck on as this NH2 group to replace the phosphoryl group that it was just carrying. And so that stuff is carbamic acid. And since it's replacing the phosphoryl, that's why you have an inorganic phosphate coming out, an orthophosphate. All right? The carbamic acid then gets phosphorylated, but now this phosphoryl group, which comes from a different ATP, gets stuck on to the other side of the molecule. That's the green phosphoryl group. And so that is carbamoyl phosphate, which we showed happening in just one step in the previous slide. All right, so all of this is catalyzed by carbamoyl phosphate synthetase happening inside the mitochondrial matrix of liver cells. All right, let's just for a second go back to the slide 8. We just made this carbamoyl phosphate, but it needs to be incorporated. It needs to be synthesized with ornithine in order to make citrulline. Well, that's what is shown on slide 10. Okay? So the ornithine is coming into the matrix in exchange for citrulline via those antiporters. The carbamoyl phosphate in pink we just manufactured via carbamoyl phosphate synthetase. And when the two combine, what's happening really is that the left part of this pink carbamoyl phosphate, everything except the phosphoryl group, gets stuck onto the end of this ornithine to make it citrulline. So this pink tip is really just everything of carbamoyl phosphate except the phosphate. And that's why you have inorganic phosphate kicking off. All right, so that's ornithine transcarbamoylase doing the job. And that citrulline is now going to leave the mitochondrial matrix as more ornithine comes in as a swap. What you've done, though, is make an intermediate in that whole cycle that is now carrying the nitrogen that used to be free ammonium inside the mitochondria. So this amino group up in citrulline's tip is one of the two amino groups that you're going to have in the overall, in the final urea product that you're making that will be spit off of the cycle. All right, now citrulline's coming out of the cell, out of the mitochondrion, and it's going to combine with aspartate, which is an amino acid also. When aspartate and citrullate combine, we make arginosuccinate. Since that requires ATP, it makes sense to call that enzyme arginosuccinate synthetase. All right, so all we've really done here is take the aspartate and hook it on to the tip of what was citrulline to make this arginosuccinate. All right, so now notice we have more nitrogen incorporated into this intermediate. We're on our way to urea. Slide 12 shows you arginosuccinate that we just produced then being transformed into arginine and fumarate. That's the split where fumarate gets spit off. Now, fumarate, really, if I just temporarily go back to 11, fumarate is just like aspartate without this amino. Okay, look at this structure here. And when we go back to slide 12, we see fumarate's just like that, except it has just a hydrogen here instead of an amino. The amino has been left on the other product, which is arginine. Okay, so we have both of these nitrogens at the tip, blue and pink. Those are going to be incorporated into urea. And so the final step is really to just take arginine. I didn't mention that this enzyme is arginosuccinase. That transforms arginosuccinate into arginate and arginine and fumarate. The final step then is to take these two nitrogens off of arginine to make urea. So basically the tip of this thing is urea, except it doesn't have the oxygen yet, right? This tip is really just urea, except this needs to be an oxygen and it needs to be on its own. So that's the final step. Incorporating that oxygen into the colored tip here, making urea, and then leaving just the black part. That final step is catalyzed by arginase, named for arginine, of course. All right? So that's being represented in slide 13, that final step right on the bottom here. Arginine gets split into urea, which is the two nitrogens and the carbon from the tip with the help of an oxygen from water. But that leaves the black part, the leftover part, which is ornithine, that completes the cycle. So the left part of slide 13, this left ring, I should say, is what we just looked at in the last few slides. That is the urea cycle. Okay? With the upper left part of the urea cycle occurring in the mitochondrial matrix, everything else occurring out in the hepatocytes, cytoplasm. But the major point of this slide is how this interconnects with the right side of the slide. The arginosuccinate, which is an intermediate of the urea cycle, remember it spits off fumarate. You see that happening right here. Splitting arginosuccinate makes fumarate and arginine. Arginine then is used to complete the cycle and spit off urea. But the fumarate, as we've said before, is an intermediate of citric acid cycle. So it can, depending on the needs of the cell, it can just go through the complete rest of the citric acid cycle to produce ATP ultimately. Or once you get up to oxaloacetate, which is really just part of the citric acid cycle, right? Fumarate, malate, oxaloacetate, remember that series? Part of the citric acid cycle? The oxaloacetate, actually, which is another version of an alpha keto acid, can itself accept an amino group from some amino acid that needs to be degraded. And when it receives the amino, that transforms oxaloacetate into aspartate, which can then be transformed into arginosuccinate. So whether the fumarate gets used to recycle arginosuccinate and therefore receive another ammonium from another amino acid, or whether it just goes on for the purpose of producing ATP via the citric acid cycle and oxidative phosphorylation, depends on the needs of the cell at the time. Okay, slide 14. What is the blue circle here? That is the citric acid cycle, right? So no modifications here. What you're seeing here is that many of the 20 protein synthesizing amino acids, once they get degraded, maybe stepwise, there might be steps involved that are represented just by these single black arrows, but once they're processed, what you make in many cases is just a citric acid cycle intermediate. And that's basically just a restatement of what I said earlier on today, that once you get rid of the amino group as waste, what's left over, the carbon skeleton and the oxygens and hydrogens that are connected to it, can be used as fuel. But not in all cases of amino acids being degraded. The 20 amino acids are listed here in different boxes, and sometimes an amino acid appears in more than one box. There are two different colors here. I should say that I noticed an error here. This yellow box on the left should be, instead of tryptophan for the third slot, it should be threonine. So change that to threonine. Isoleucine, leucine, and threonine. Okay? Well, the difference in the colors here, pink or yellow, is in whether the breakdown product of the amino acid degradation can lead to production of glucose or not. All right? In most cases, it can. Those are the pink boxes. So the amino acids listed in pink are acting as what we call glucogenic amino acids, because their breakdown produces something that can feed into the citric acid cycle at a place that allows for the net synthesis of glucose. All right? Notice that there's not all that many different fates for the amino acids. Even though there's 20 different amino acids, breaking them down is going to lead to the production of either alpha-ketoglutarate, succinyl coenzyme A, fumarate, oxaloacetate, pyruvate, acetyl coenzyme A, or acetoacetyl coenzyme A. All right? So those seven compounds I just mentioned, any given amino acid of the 20 turns into one of those after a few steps, maybe. Well, all of those except for acetyl coenzyme A or acetoacetyl coenzyme A can lead to the net production of glucose. But remember, acetyl coenzyme A cannot. Do you remember why? Or at least it can't in animals. Do you remember why it can't? Well, we can feed acetyl coenzyme A into the citric acid cycle, of course. But when we do that, and all we have is the citric acid cycle to work with, remember that there are two decarboxylation steps. So we end up dismantling the carbon skeleton and therefore don't make any headway. We don't have any net synthesis of glucose because we lose carbons in those decarboxylation steps. Remember, plants can get around that problem by operating the glyoxylate cycle, and bacteria can. Remember, the glyoxylate cycle is very similar to citric acid cycle, but doesn't involve any decarboxylations. Well, when you skip at least one of those decarboxylations, which all of these pink boxes are doing, then you can build up carbon skeletons and therefore make glucose. But for the amino acids that are being degraded in such a way as to produce either acetoacetyl coenzyme A or acetyl coenzyme A, which of course are reversibly transformable, then you don't have any net glucose synthesis. So the ones in the yellow boxes are acting as what are called ketogenic amino acids. Because remember, from acetoacetyl coenzyme A, you can also make ketone bodies like we talked about. Well, of the ones that are listed in yellow, the only ones that occur only in yellow boxes are leucine and lysine. Because even though isoleucine, threonine, phenylalanine, tryptophan, and tyrosine occur in yellow boxes, they also occur in pink boxes elsewhere. So the only two amino acids that are strictly ketogenic are leucine and lysine, because they don't occur in any pink boxes. Okay? Some are strictly glucogenic, some are either, and those two are strictly ketogenic. All right, I only have a few more slides left, and here's where we really gloss over the details, because what actually happens in the individual cases of all those 20 amino acids listed in the boxes, those are where all the different pathways come into play, and that's where we just don't have time to go over all those particulars. But I wanted to mention a couple examples of specific amino acids, just to mention the use of oxidases. Oxidases are enzymes that use molecular oxygen, O2 in other words. Now, we've been used to thinking of oxygen as serving what purpose? Final electron acceptor in cellular respiration, right. And that's by far what most of the oxygen we breathe is used for. But there are also, 90% at least of the oxygen you breathe goes into accepting electrons and protons to become water, metabolic water. But there are also hundreds of other cases that combine to make up the other 10% of your use of oxygen. And the enzymes that somehow use this molecular oxygen in the various processes are called oxygenases. Well, there are two major classes of oxygenases: monooxygenases and dioxygenases. The difference is that a monooxygenase uses only one of the two oxygens to incorporate into the product, or the main product, I guess I should say. The other oxygen, of course, an oxygen molecule has two oxygens. The other oxygen gets reduced into water if it's a monooxygenase. A dioxygenase is an enzyme that uses a molecule of oxygen and incorporates both of those oxygen atoms into that major product. Okay? Well, there are a couple of amino acids that have aromatic rings as part of their R group. Phenylalanine is an example shown here. Well, these aren't the only things that include aromatic rings. Of course, there are rings in cholesterol, for instance. There's rings in various kinds of molecules. A typical use of oxygenase enzymes, though, is to break rings. And a typical use of a monooxidase is to hydroxylate a ring, which is a step in preparing for the breaking of that ring. And that's really what you're seeing here in the degradation of phenylalanine. Now, Since monooxidases typically work to hydroxylate the ring, they're often called also hydroxylases, and that's why this enzyme is called phenylalanine hydroxylase. That's just a specific example. I just wanted to give you introduce the concept of monooxygenases just so that you knew oxygen is used for something other than cellular respiration. But what's happening is that one of the two oxygens in this water molecule gets stuck on with the help of a hydrogen atom as a hydroxyl group on the ring. When you do that to phenylalanine, you transform it into tyrosine, another ringed amino acid. But that tyrosine then is going to be degraded using other oxygenases. This involves, by the way, a cofactor called tetrahydrobiopterin, which is the source of the hydrogens required to make... You have to stick a couple hydrogens onto one of the two oxygen atoms to make water, right? That's how a monooxygenase works, I said. You also need a hydrogen to make this hydroxyl. But the source of the hydrogens directly comes from tetrahydrobiopterin. That cofactor, though, gets recycled by receiving hydrogens itself from coenzymes, NADH. All right, so you always have tetrahydrobiopterin being recycled, and therefore you can keep doing this. Phenylalanine is shown in slide 16. And dealing with that ringed structure is going to involve two different... I'm on the wrong slide. Phenylalanine gets transformed into various intermediates, which I don't want you to memorize at all. But notice that... What's that? What did I say wrong? No, I don't even, not even, let alone the enzymes involved, but the intermediates here don't really matter. The point here is that you need to break a ring, and when you break a ring, you really just are opening it up, which is why this homogentisate, which is one of the intermediates, when it gets turned into the one on the bottom here, this is just an open ring. And now that's more of a standard. That's now it's able to be processed just like the amino acids that do not involve a ring. Okay, so that's just the main point of that. But this is, notice that phenylalanine is getting turned in eventually into acetoacetate. So that qualifies it as what kind of amino acid? A ketogenic amino acid, exactly. And then in the final slide, which is where I thought I was originally when I started 16, in slide 17 we were dealing with the tryptophan that we just produced two slides ago by that hydroxylation, right? I'm sorry. This is a totally different amino acid, but it has a ring of itself. It has two rings. Two rings, both of which need to be broken, and it's going to require two dioxygenases and a monooxygenase to do that. So it's going to require three separate oxygen molecules in order to break both of these tryptophan rings, leading to acetoacetate again. So this is another ketogenic amino acid. Once again, I don't want you to memorize any of these intermediates, but just notice the difference between how the dioxygenase is working compared to the monooxygenase. This first dioxygenase that's working, both of those oxygens end up being put into the product. Right? The two pink oxygens are stuck onto the carbons that used to be stuck together in the ring. That opens up the ring, one of the rings. When the monooxygenase works, just one of the two oxygens gets incorporated into the product. The other one gets incorporated into a water molecule. That's the definition of a monooxygenase. You still have one ring, though, which is why you need another dioxygenase and another water molecule coming in here. The hydroxylation step that the monooxygenase performed, that basically just prepares the ring for the final breaking by a dioxygenase. And once you open that, then you have a easier time dealing with the carbon skeleton, transforming it into acetoacetate. And so that's enough.